You're listening to CHSR 97.9 FM. Welcome to This Week in Fredericton, the show that takes a deep dive into the latest news from your community. I'm your host, Zach Roman, and in this week's episode, we talk to the people behind a unique marketing campaign created in response to construction that could impact their downtown businesses, and Dr. Mary Louise McCarthy, who's part of the team putting on this weekend's inaugural Still Here Emancipation Celebration Festival in Fredericton. You may have heard of cities with an arts district or historic district, but how about one with a construction district? Fredericton's construction district is now open, thanks to the creative marketing efforts of five Fredericton restaurants impacted by the Westmoreland Street construction project. Staff at Scouts, Rustico, Coastline Pizza and More, St. Louis Bar and Grill, and The Cove by First Light Distillery have teamed up to put a positive spin on a situation that could have been bad for business. Westmoreland Street is closed right now between King and Queen Streets, and in the prime summer season, the businesses feared the closure would deter foot and car traffic to their locations. So, the businesses started their construction district marketing campaign to share parking information, promote detours, and create incentives to visit their spots. We sat down with two of the people behind the construction district campaign to discuss the current situation.
I'm Jenny Wilson. I'm co-owner of 11th Mile Food Company, which is two restaurants in downtown Fredericton and a catering business. We have 11th Mile on York Street. And the restaurant that's involved in this initiative is Coastline Pizza and More, which is down almost to Queen Street on Westmoreland.
And my name is Kelly Grant. I'm the general manager of King West Brewery and Rustico Restaurant, which is down on the corner of Westmoreland and King Street.
So this year, Westmoreland Street between King and Queen has been closed mid-July, and it'll run right through, now we're hearing, probably until November or December. So this is a major impact for downtown businesses, but in particular restaurants that rely on walk-in traffic and the visibility aspect of looking open. So that's a significant summer season, but also running right through harvest, which is a very important time for our businesses. We're also aware that next year, the construction's just going to move up a block. So that will be just on the south side of King for a whole nother summer. So that's one of the reasons we decided we needed to maybe put our heads together and come up with an initiative to get us through these next few summers where we're missing peak business times.
And we decided to do it in a really positive way, as opposed to being in a negative way where, you know, it's really easy to complain about the fact that we're going to have all this construction and, you know, people aren't going to be able to get there and that sort of thing that you get idea in your head, but it's not true. It's actually quite easy to get to us. Just have to know where you're going. And we wanted to really make this a fun thing. And so we came up with the name, the Construction District.
The businesses have spent a long time preparing to address any construction challenges.
Well, Jenny messaged us, myself and Kunj, the general manager at St. Louis, and Dee and Ben from Scouts, and then Jennifer at First Light. And we all got together in February and decided, Jenny's the one that actually brought us together and said, you know, guys, like, let's talk about this and how we are going to be able to approach this. And like, let's do this in a way that, you know, is positive for all of our restaurants, which is really quite unheard of for all these restaurants to come together that are typically competition for one another. And just to say, like, what can we do as a team? And we were all like right from day one, yes, let's do this. Now, we didn't know what we were going to do, but we knew we wanted to do something. And so we met every Tuesday for a couple of hours in the afternoon and just brainstormed.
We had identified our key goals as to inform the public of what was going on, to incentivize the public to continue to come down, and to create some branding that would benefit all of us through the next 2 years. So once we zoned in on those goals, the rest of it followed quite easily. I mean, we've got a handful of entrepreneurs and some very creative people sitting at the table with one goal. I think we found the process a lot more fun than...
Way more fun than we thought.
And much easier.
The first order of business was addressing questions the public might have.
So we wanted to make sure that we were sending out messaging that we knew our customers would have questions about where can we park, how can we drive, where do we get to your businesses. We had a couple of partners within the community. Certainly downtown Fredericton was very helpful to us in terms of some providing some signage, just saying, hey, we're still open, and hey, here's where the pedestrian pathways are. That's very important for the general public to see. The city of Fredericton was useful to us as well. For instance, coming down Westmoreland, they've removed, there used to be a no left turn there. Now you can turn left so that we're not, otherwise we'd be completely choked off from getting traffic around there. And then we had some private partners as well. John Khalil, who old Fredericktonians will know, used to own the Sheraton back in the day when my husband and I worked there, and we worked for him. He was nice enough to allow us to use that big parking lot right on the corner of Westmoreland and Queen every evening and all weekend through construction. He's going to leave that open and let people park there for free. This also allows us, one of our major concerns is how are our DoorDash drivers going to get the food? So this allows, we've completely removed the parking problem, and it allows us to continue doing day-to-day business. So we're extremely grateful for those partnerships and the support we've received to keep people understanding how to move through that area. And Shane Sutherland, also at SNS Tire right there on Brunswick, he's letting us use his parking lot in the evenings too. So we've been able to do infographics, get help from downtown Fredericton in creating visuals that will allow people to say, look, there's more parking now than there was before.
The Maine Institute as well, beside Rustico, does in the evenings other than Thursdays and the weekends.
The restaurants have created an incentives program to thank customers for coming during the construction period.
Yeah, we thought it would be something nice to be able to thank our guests for coming in and having some prizes for them available. So we've got some really great prizes. The first prize is July 31st is being drawn, is two ultimate passes to Harvest. So for every $25 you spend in any one of our restaurants, you get a ballot. You fill out a ballot. So if you spend $75, you get three. And then as far as the rest of the prizes, we have a wine dinner being donated by Rustico. We have a weekend at the Hollows. We have a full golf package being done. I'm forgetting something, Jenny. What am I?
There's a couple others that are in the works.
In the works. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We have a really great grand prize, but we haven't told anybody yet. So that's a bit of a surprise. So yeah, we're just kind of doing it that way and having fun with it. And, you know, hoping that it's not necessarily just a way to drive people in, but it's a way of saying thank you. Just saying thank you for coming and supporting us during this construction time. And the support has been amazing. We have been so thrilled, and people have just been so positive about it, and a lot of great comments about watching people coming together, especially local restaurants coming together and having this camaraderie together, and it's just not seen every day. So it's been a really positive thing for us.
That's a really interesting thing about this partnership, is you have everything from a small sandwich shop within a larger business to a national chain, St. Louis, working together. So our needs are very different, our perspectives are very different, but we combined our efforts to say, okay, what are each of our needs and how can we address them?
Initial results from the marketing campaign seem to be promising.
So we had a really good week this week, and you know, I don't know. I said we've had a lot of people talking about it. So I did a special Tuesday night at Rustico that was a construction district special, and it drove a lot of people in. So it was really great, and people were coming in and saying, you know, where's the Rustico Tuesday special? They were literally coming in and saying, we're here for the construction district special, which really made me happy, because then, you know, the message is being heard. The business has been good this week for all of us. So we're just fingers crossed that this is going to continue. The summers are what our businesses survive on. You know, the winters are, you know, there as well. But the summers, especially for a place like myself and all of us that have patios. I mean, the patios are bread and butter through the summer. So construction doesn't happen in the winter. So we had to figure out a way to, you know, keep ourselves going. So hopefully it's going to continue.
Yeah, all the business owners this week, Scouts and St. Louis and us at Coastline, you at Rustico, we all reported better weeks than certainly than we expected. So, you know, it's two-pronged. One is around sort of just getting a fun project going and keeping our own spirits up,
keeping
us engaged. But then seeing this swell of support feels really good. And so we're just super appreciative. The relationship that's been formed in response to this construction project, I cannot imagine a world in which it will not continue in some way. So we will continue to work together to keep this corner vibrant and to draw attention to sort of the fun little situation that's evolved there, where you've got a pile of eateries where previously there was very little.
For updates from the construction district, you can follow them on social media.
So we have online presence on Facebook and on Instagram, and that's Dee from Scout has really taken the ownership of our social media, and we really appreciate that. Yep, so that can be found at the constructiondistrict.yfc, which is, of course, our airport code. YFC is the Fredericton code, so constructiondistrict.yfc. And that will keep you up to date on any changes with traffic flow, parking, prizes, who the winners of our draws are, all that kind of stuff. And then even this kind of fun thing, behind the scenes, you know, what are we working on right now?
Construction on Westmoreland Street began Monday, July 13th. And is expected to continue into the fall before resuming next construction season. If you're just tuning in, welcome to This Week in Fredericton on CHSR 97.9 FM. I'm your host, Zach Roman, and this is the show that takes a deep dive into the latest news from your community. A new festival honoring four centuries of Black heritage, resilience, and community in New Brunswick begins this evening and will run all weekend. Still Here, Emancipation Celebration will feature the launch of a new book and exhibition at the Beaverbrook Art Gallery, the raising of the Pan-African flag at the Legislative Assembly of New Brunswick, an academic conference, live music, poetry, a play, and much more. A full schedule of this weekend's events is available on the Still Here website, stillherefestival.ca. The book that's being launched is called Still Here, Preserving Our Legacy, and it plays a major role in the festival. The book is a chronicle of Black New Brunswick history and features archival research, historical documents, original poetry, and stories from and photography of 15 Black families that are still here. Dr. Mary Louise McCarthy is one of the book's authors and is part of the team that put together this weekend's festival.
I'm Mary Louise McCarthy. I'm a sixth generation African-Canadian. I can date my ancestors back in New Brunswick back to the 1700s when the Black Loyalists came into New Brunswick. New Brunswick was formed in 1784, and my fifth great-grandmother arrived in October of 1783. Well, this is our first running of the festival. We started out with a book, and in the book I was asked by my son to find some families who wanted to talk about their history, and I was able to find 15 families who wanted to share their history, and we eventually got a book publisher on board, and they were Goose Lane Editions. And from doing all the work, and I guess the way the project was set up was I found the family reps, and then my other team members, my son and Gary Weeks and Jeannie Redeker, the three other members, all would go visit the families at an agreed upon time, would interview them, and specifically take pictures and scan any archival documents. So this was kind of different because historically there were a fair amount of researchers wanted to be involved in New Brunswick Black history, but unfortunately they were of European descent. They would go to the families, they would extract the information and or documents, and then the communities never heard from them again. And they felt very, very I guess, abused. So when my son designed this project, he said, we are never going to disrespect the families. We are going to go to them at their agreed upon time. We're going to scan whatever old pictures or documents or newspapers that they are comfortable sharing. I'll bring the scanner with me while Gary's taking the photos. Jeannie did behind-the-scene photos. My son, Tondaway, did the actual scanning of the documents. And so now we have a beautiful book. It's called Still Here, Preserving Our Legacy. The book is in two parts. Because I am a historian, I worked on a timeline. Part one is a timeline from 1783 to 2022. And then part two of the book is the 15 families. Each family did a little essay. We have older pictures. We have archival documents, as well as Gary Weeks, our photographer, took over 400 pictures. So the book has a selection of pictures, but the exhibit has a whole lot more, and you can see different shots in each presentation. So you wouldn't just see at the exhibit that's at the Beaverbrook pictures that you saw in the book.
The Still Here book and exhibition launch runs from 5 to 8 p.m. tonight at the Beaverbrook Art Gallery, which is located at 703 Queen Street. In Canada, August 1st is Emancipation Day. It marks the actual day in 1834 that the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833 came into effect across the British Empire.
Emancipation was only day was only proclaimed in Canada by our then Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in 2021. But we were successful, myself and a small group of people, to do a campaign to speak to the MLAs. And we had Emancipation Day proclaimed in the legislature in June of 2022. So now it's officially on the New Brunswick calendar. It's now in the law, and the vote was 39-0. We had a very successful motion on the legislative floor.
The Pan-African flag raising at the legislature is being held on Emancipation Day.
The Pan-African raising is something that the Heritage Department has done. This is their second year, and they're doing that at 9 o'clock. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm certainly going. I'm not sure who's showing up, but it's what the provincial government is doing to support the provincial government calendar. And so that's 9 o'clock. But we ourselves, because of the Still Here project, and because the families are here for the weekend, we're having speeches at 12 noon in front of the Beaverbrook Art Gallery. And then we are doing a Still Here family photo. And we're hoping to have one of the largest black family photos ever taken in New Brunswick. And then at 2 o'clock, we're crossing the street from the art gallery and we're going to the legislature and we're having a big photo of African, Black, Caribbean people, whoever wants to join.
The Still Here Festival will play an important role in ensuring the history of Black families in New Brunswick will not be forgotten.
I know my timeline really well because I've done the research, and my fifth great grandmother was enslaved in a plantation in Virginia. And she and two children came, traveled up to New York and was able to you have to pledge to this white European man called Captain Birch. It's called the Birch Papers. You read the Birch Paper, you pledge to it, and that allowed you passage onto a ship into it was 1700, so it was into what was then called Acadia or Nova Scotia, because New Brunswick and Nova Scotia only separated in 1784. And that particular woman, my fifth great grandmother, escaped slavery in the U.S., but was re-enslaved or indentured in Nova Scotia to a family, a loyalist family, the family of Isaac Allen. And Isaac Allen was a lawyer from New Jersey. and Isaac Allen helped negotiate the divide of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. So there was a lot of false promises, and I always say that the reason I look like I do is because the black people leaned on the indigenous people to learn about farming and agriculture. If you're coming from Africa into the southern U.S. and then you're here in Canada, how are you going to learn how to cook, what to grow, you know, what fresh fruits you can, you know, the wild fruits, the berries, which is good, which is bad. So there were a lot of partnerships made from the indigenous communities and also relationships.
To learn more about the Still Here project and for a full schedule of this weekend's events, visit stillherefestival.ca.
I'm excited that we are here at this point and that it's going to be a hectic weekend, but we've got a phenomenal team. Like, we are so blessed to have the humans we're working with. And there's not one thing I can say other than I'm happy to be part of the team and I'm happy to celebrate those 15 families.
Thanks for listening to This Week in Fredericton, the show that takes a deep dive into the latest news from your community. I'm your host, Zach Roman, and I also do daily news updates. One story I reported on this week was about a rise in food bank usage in New Brunswick. In case you missed it, here's the story. Food bank use in New Brunswick has increased significantly, according to a new report from FeedNB and the Human Development Council. The report shows that over 28,000 unique individuals were served by food banks in April of this year, a 60% increase since September of 2022. Over 5,000 of those individuals were served right here in Fredericton. The report also highlights a number of operational, infrastructure, staffing, and volunteer challenges that food banks and community kitchens are facing as they work to keep up with increased demand. CHSR met with two of the report's authors to discuss the situation.
Yeah, my name is Liam Fisher, and I am the Data Analyst and Research Coordinator at the Human Development Council.
My name is Heather Atchison, and I'm the Social Researcher at the Human Development Council.
It was three demographics that stood out to us as having some higher increases than just general food bank increase overall, or their counterparts, which are post-secondary students, recent immigrants, and families with employment income. And I think if we take those three things together, it kind of speaks to the affordability challenges of New Brunswickers that are worse in recent years than other years, and how food banks are stepping in to fill in that gap where employment incomes and things like that aren't sufficient.
The report highlights that more and more, food banks are becoming an essential service.
Food banks and community kitchens were designed to be an emergency sort of service, but as you mentioned, more and more they're becoming a necessary part of kind of the fabric of our society to help meet food security needs. But what we also talk about in the report are some of the challenges that food banks and community kitchens are facing, and some of those challenges are around capacity issues. Sometimes the buildings are in need of repair and they don't have adequate funding to be able to cover that. They're also facing kind of like an aging workforce, and they rely a lot on volunteers who are also aging. And if they're not seeing younger volunteers and increased numbers of volunteers coming to help them, it really does put strain on their operations. And then it puts the future of these operations in question, really, because there's just unprecedented demand and it doesn't look like there's a sustainable path forward.
What we've definitely called attention to in the report is the fact that volunteers are down since COVID, community donations are down since COVID. The food banks have reported they definitely don't feel like government support has increased proportional to the level of increase that they've seen in service they've had to provide. So all these factors coming together really put a lot of strain on food banks and community kitchens.
Sure. We have a number of recommendations in the report, but just to name a few here, the first is all around increasing funding so that food agencies, community kitchens, and food banks can continue to sustain their operations. This recommendation just calls attention to the fact that current funding levels are inadequate and the cost of food, as we all know, is so high. So increased funding will just help keep those organizations going. We also talk about exploring different models of food agency service delivery. As I mentioned, some capacity gaps were highlighted in our report findings. So sometimes buildings are not up to code or out where they need to be to continue to provide the service, but there are flexible options like mobile food banks and satellite food banks. And these are just more flexible options where food agencies can continue to deliver their important service and really meet people where they're at. We also want to continue our partnership with FeedNB, the Human Development Council, and to continue to build an advocacy platform for FeedNB's members. That way, they have the tools required to communicate their needs, influence decision-making, and then continue to generate awareness about food security and why it's so important. And then, of course, our long-term recommendation is just to really focus on those underlying economic and social pressures that are causing people to rely on food banks and community kitchens and to experience food insecurity in the first place. So that's more of a systems level issue. And the way that we've organized our report recommendations is like starting from the most immediate things that we can do towards the more long-term sustainability endeavors.
And one of our recommendations is flexible spending. The typical association of supporting a food bank for people in the general public would be, well, I'll give money for food purchasing. But with the introduction of FeedNB and the food recovery program, you know, there's certainly more support to food banks and community kitchens regarding the food that they're provided and able to distribute. But one of the big challenges is not actually money for food, it's money for staffing and rent and workforce recruitment and retention. So one of the big recommendations is not only increased funding, but funding that's flexible and can be spent on things beyond food purchasing, like staffing and rent specifically.
We certainly do call attention to the inadequate wages and then the reliance that food agencies do have on volunteer labor. And just in the kind of community research that I've done in general, something that I have seen and I've heard in qualitative interviews is the notion that sometimes people that are doing this work, whether it's in paid or unpaid positions, are actually experiencing some of the challenges of the folks that they are helping. So sometimes people that are in community-facing roles are actually experiencing food insecurity or housing insecurity themselves, just because sometimes working in these sectors, they may not have the same sorts of like benefits and different things that other positions may have that are not in the kind of community and nonprofit sector. So there's definitely challenges for working in these positions. And it just always inspires me so much that people continue to show up and do this really important work day after day just because they believe in it so much.
Thanks for listening to This Week in Fredericton, the show that takes a deep dive into the latest news from your community. We're on the air every Friday from 11:30 a.m. to noon, right here on CHSR 97.9 FM. If you have a news tip, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us by email at news@chsrfm.ca. I'm Zach Roman, and that was This Week in Fredericton.